This is American Real, where we aim to inspire, empower, and enlighten you through the stories of our guests. Here's your host, Roger Brooks.
Can you take us back when the diagnosis came to be? Give us an idea of what that journey was like, especially for the early years, because I believe that's the most important for parents who are coming into a situation like this.
In the early days, I wasn't confident helping him. I was very interested, but I wasn't confident because it's a very complex condition, because even though it's caused by a brain injury, the condition develops as the child grows. An orthopedic surgeon in 1991 published a book on cerebral palsy, particularly gait analysis in cerebral palsy. And even though it was a book written by an orthopedic surgeon for orthopedic surgeons, and like I read it with the medical dictionary beside me, I still got a lot of useful information out of it.
Let me guess, you're an entrepreneur looking for ways to grow your business online. And you've probably tried everything to grow your business, including social media, SEO, even paid ads, only to find out that nothing truly works. So what if I told you that writing a book that goes on to become a bestseller is the magic wand, and that you can do it in as little as 30 days, 2 weeks, or even over a weekend in some cases, without spending more than 10 minutes a day? Would you be interested? My name is Roger Brooks, and I'm the founder and host of American Real TV, where I interview world-class guests to empower others through the essence of story. But I didn't get here overnight, and my mission certainly doesn't end here. Ever since I was a little boy, it's been my dream to empower others through the craft of writing and storytelling. And throughout my life, I came across several mentors who pushed me toward my passion for writing books and helping others to do the same. There is no greater joy than to be working with aspiring authors and to help them establish true credibility within their industry by writing and publishing their first book, which I'm proud to say have all gone on to become bestsellers. Now, you're seeing this video because I just opened enrollment for my new book writing program, where I promise to take you from page one to published in 90 days or less. I will be personally working with you to overcome the same fears and obstacles that kept me from pursuing my dreams all of those years. Simply click on the link below to see how I could help you become a first-time best-selling author. I look forward to seeing you on the inside.
This is American Real. I am Roger Brooks. My guest today is Lily Collison. You are the author of the new book, Spastic Diplegia Bilateral Cerebral Palsy, and have a science background with a degree in medical microbiology. You live in Ireland with your husband and also have three adult sons, one of which, Tommy, we're going to talk about today. You say that your journey of learning about CP reminds you of the Irish expression, which I'll let you say, but it means 20 years a-growing. Lily, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you for having me here.
Absolutely. And I've had a chance now over the last couple of weeks since you sent me this book, your book, to read through it. And as I was telling you before we started, I love how you put this together with all the medical facts. And I know you had some help with that part, but I love your piece. And I found myself just going to those pieces because I was interested in what you had to say. So first of all, congratulations, a wonderful job. This book is needed in the world because we'll talk about some of the statistics. A large number of people are born with CP, right?
Absolutely. Well, like 17 million people worldwide live with CP. And like what shocked me most in writing the book was the number of adults who said, you know, that they learned from reading the book. Like these are adults who've lived with the condition, and like even research shows, you know, a research showed that a study of young adults who had the condition that their greatest area of unmet need was information about the condition. And that shocked me, you know, that if you've lived your life with this condition and you're still hungry for information, like I could understand for me as a parent of a newly diagnosed child, but I found it, you know, it really saddened me to think that adults living with the condition still want more information. That's why, one of the reasons.
Absolutely. And why do you think that is? Do you think it's like this with other diseases, or was this a rare case where there wasn't much information out there already?
To some extent, that's a very good question. To some extent, cerebral palsy is a kind of a spectrum, say autism, you know, there's a spectrum. Cerebral palsy, there are about six main subtypes. And before now, like there are good books on cerebral palsy, but they're about all the subtypes together. So if you're a parent who have a newly diagnosed child with a subtype, one of the six subtypes, you only care about the subtype your child has. And you don't care about the other subtypes because they're not relevant. Like, it's like if you have cancer, if you have throat cancer, you only want to know anything about throat cancer. You don't want to know about the other cancers. And to some extent, there have been very good books on CP, but they're all subtypes together. And I'll give you a sort of a small example. Like, it would say that some people with CP, I'm shortening cerebral palsy to CP, some people with CP may develop epilepsy, right? So I'll read this. I'm the parent of a newly diagnosed child. I read that some people, how am I as a parent to be qualified to know, does this apply in my case or not? And like, as it happens, I worried about epilepsy for a long time because I had read that, and not relevant to that subtype. So there are books on CP, but it's treating it as one condition, and it really is a number of different conditions, and they all vary in severity, they vary in management plans, they vary in prognosis. So treating them all together kind of confuses the issue, because I'm not qualified to pick what's relevant to my subtype, and it's like six different conditions. So to some extent, professionals need to know about all the subtypes. Sure. Parents only need to know about one. And I personally believe that deep medical books were written by professionals, right, for families. But what information professionals, you know, they can't be books, like, they're writing books as if they were writing for professionals. Now, they're okay trying to make it accessible, but I only want the narrow information for my diagnosis. So what I'm trying to do is sift through the noise, take away anything that's irrelevant, and put in all the relevant. And there's a lot, like when you see how much there's relevant, there's a lot, you know, that there's plenty to be going on with, and there's plenty to, you know, there's plenty of concerns, but you certainly don't need things that aren't of concern.
Right. No, it makes total sense. And as a parent, that's what I would want, is just to cut through all that and be able to read what is really specific for our child. So if we can, we'll come back to the book, but I'd love to go. First of all, I had a chance to watch the video of the book release that you did. And I was particularly struck by Tommy's introduction before you came on stage. And he talked about, look, my mom was, you know, had two boys already before I was born. She was working, a husband, a family. And then, you know, I come along and now, you know, there's a new diagnosis here, and she didn't really expect that. Can you take us back to those early days of when the diagnosis came to be? And then if you could just kind of give us an idea of what that journey was like, especially for the early years, because I believe that's the most important for parents who are coming into a situation like this, whether it's CP or anything.
Or any condition, yeah. I suppose, like, okay, as you know, I have three children, and Tommy is the youngest of the three. So, like, when Tommy was born, I had a six-year-old and a four-year-old. And I think on your first child, you're there, you're reading the books, and you're looking, you know, 1 month, is he doing all the things 2 months, you're doing all the things, you know, you're really hyper as a parent. By the time you've come to your third, they rear themselves to some extent. Yes. And to some extent, it was a little bit like that. That, like, I'd had two children and they were different. Like, the first was very, a very busy child. The second was a more relaxed child. So I was kind of, I had seen the differences in two children. Tommy comes along. Now, to some extent, when Tommy was born, he was born and it was a totally normal pregnancy, normal birth. But when he was born, he started crying immediately. He was born on a Friday and all day Saturday, he cried, cried, cried. And okay, I wasn't used to the crying, like, you know, two babies, I had successfully breastfed babies and everything. So, you know, it was the pitch of the cry struck me as odd. And by the Saturday evening, I asked a pediatrician, would you check Tommy out? And she came, checked Tommy. I said, I don't like the pitch of the cry. She came, checked Tommy out, and she said, everything's fine, nothing going on here. And now I was very happy to hear that. Like, I had a slight concern at the pitch of the cry, but when she said, no, don't be worrying, you know, you're worrying unnecessarily, all that, I was very happy to hear that. So we took Tommy home and the crying went on and it was incessant. I was trying to feed him. And 3 weeks later, my physician said, just give up here. You're stopping feeding this baby today because, oh, he was returning all the feeds and it was just terribly stressful. So that continued for 3 months of nonstop and they were treating him for colic and all sorts of things. And after 3 months, he suddenly calmed down and became the most placid, serene baby. And we said, phew, we thought everything was over, we're back, you know, whatever that was, it's done with now. And the next few months, nothing, you know, he was so easy. But then in routine checks, they were saying, we're not so sure here. And again, I was quite relaxed because I sort of thought, normal difference. I wouldn't have been as aware then as I am now of the alarm bells that are going off if a child doesn't begin crawling, if a child doesn't begin independent sitting. I wasn't as tuned into those alarm bells. He was termed developmentally delayed. So when he was a year old, this had been going on for a few months, I decided, like, developmentally delayed doesn't help you much. I didn't have something, you know, to work on. So someone had mentioned to me that there's a very straight-talking pediatrician. Why don't you take him to him? So I decided, yeah, I'll go for a second opinion to this pediatrician. And I wasn't expecting anything. And like, if it was a big appointment, my husband and myself would go. I was quite happy to take Tommy off to the appointment on my own. And as it happened, I had the other children with me. You know, I wasn't thinking, you know, expecting, you know, much information, to be honest. So I took the other children with me and bribed them. You know, if they stayed really quiet in the waiting room, we'll go to McDonald's nearby afterwards. Went into the appointment and the pediatrician, the usual pleasantries, and the pediatrician examined Tommy. And then he looked up at me and he said, "Do you not know what's wrong with this child?" And I thought to myself, then that's why I'm here. I said, "No," very politely. And he said, "Yes, cerebral palsy. And what's more," is what he followed it up with, "what's more, if I want to know how this child will turn out, I don't look at the child, I look at the mother." And that was my diagnosis. And like, in a sense, I was shocked, but I was also kind of relieved because, you know, after all this, you know, sort of, we're worried, there's developmental delay, but there's no name, there's no diagnosis. And after all that, I was shocked, but I was relieved. And like, it was funny, I always thought when I ever passed that McDonald's, it transports me exactly back to that day. Like, I can't pass that McDonald's without thinking of that day. But like, it was funny that day, and like I wrote about it in the book, that one dazed mother and three lively children went to that McDonald's. I was so dazed to hear that, and like that was like, if that day all I would have, now I wouldn't have known that's what I needed. But that day, I would have wanted someone to hand me this book because that's what I needed, was just solid information. Because once we got the diagnosis, and then that allowed things to start in terms of services for him and that, like PT, physical therapy, you know, it allowed that to kick in and different services. But if I got the book, you know, because in the early days, I wasn't confident helping him. I was very interested, but I wasn't confident because it's a very complex condition, because even though it's caused by a brain injury, it's caused by a brain injury at some stage, and we don't know when. Like, most likely in our case, it was caused during pregnancy, that he had a stroke during pregnancy. We don't know, but that's likely what happened. But in the early days, he's presented like the child would have very stiff muscles and things like that. But the condition develops as the child grows. So in the first few years, as the child's growing, he's kind of changing in front of you. Like, he starts with very stiff muscles. And then as he grows, his muscle growth isn't keeping up with his bone growth. So therefore, his joints get pulled out of position. So he might start being able to stand, you know, erect, but suddenly his knees get flexed, his hips get flexed. So what I found very complex was the child was changing before me. And really it is that the primary problems caused by the brain injury lead to growth problems. And that's why the child changes. And what I wanted was a good explanation of that. And I just didn't have it. You know, I was searching around, like, I'd scour bookshops in any city I visited. I'd go to bookstores, see if I can find information. And that's why, I came across a book written by an orthopedic surgeon at Gillette when Tommy was about 5, 6 at the time. I came across his physical therapist gave me a book written by an orthopedic surgeon at Gillette. The people I wrote the book in conjunction with Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. But it was an orthopedic surgeon in 1991 had published a book on cerebral palsy, particularly gait analysis in cerebral palsy. And he had a chapter on spastic diplegia itself. And it was the first concrete information I read about spastic diplegia. And even though it was a book written by an orthopedic surgeon for orthopedic surgeons, and like I read it with a medical dictionary beside me, I still got a lot of useful information out of it.
Wow. But I could see how frustrating that could be when you're in the moment and there's really not much information out there. So again, the fact that you put this together, all this hard work, is going to help, you know, hopefully millions of families that are going through the same things that you and your husband did in those early days. So let's talk about, as Tommy gets older, what was it like? I know there's a lot of PT. How about surgeries and things like that, the big decisions you had to make?
Yeah, it's funny when you say it. I remember saying to my sister at one stage that having a child with a disability that needs a lot of input, right? It's like, I remember saying to my sister at one stage, I could run two families you have your family, but you have this workload with a child with a disability that needs a lot of input. Like, it's very different, a lifelong, and I'll come back to the surgery just in one sec, but a lifelong condition, you know, I remember our middle son got meningitis in his final year at high school, right? It turned out to be viral meningitis in the end, they think, but they had to treat it as if it was bacterial. So he's severe headaches, whatever, goes into the ER, immediately brought to lumbar puncture, pumped with antibiotics, and thankfully he had a very good outcome. But I just had to be there. I had nothing to do. You know, there were no decisions. The medical team made all the decisions. An acute episode, very different with a lifelong chronic condition. You know, the parent is much more involved because there's the care from the professionals, but there's also a lot you have to do at home. A lot of, you know, there's a lot of work that has to be done at home. So it's quite, you know, it's quite involved. Now, you asked me about surgeries. As it happened, when I came across the book, the 1991 book by Dr. Gage, when I read that book, And the professionals I was dealing with in the services in Ireland knew I was very interested in learning. So Dr. Gage, as it happened, came to Ireland to deliver a lecture. It was just after 9/11 he came, because I remember he always spoke about he had the airplane to himself on the way over because flying had stopped, you know, just after 9/11. But anyway, he gave a lecture in 2001 in Ireland, and I heard him speak. And I thought, if Tommy ever needs orthopedic surgery, I'm going to write Dr. Gage. You know, this is in the days, this 2001, like email with attachments and PDFs weren't yet invented. Well, email was, but, you had to use snail mail to send reports. But anyway, and Tommy then needed surgery in shortly after that. I wrote to Dr. Gage and we went to Minnesota. We took Tommy from Ireland to Minnesota for his first major surgery. And like, that was interesting in the sense that I had a very good relationship with the professionals here, but you know, it was a big deal to come from Ireland to Minnesota for surgery. But we had no doubt at what about what we were doing. And like, there were a few reasons that we were so confident that this was the right thing to do. Because there were outcome studies published, you know, where they would analyze, you know, so many children had had this surgery and, you know, this percentage of them improved on this metric, this percentage improved on this metric. So they had done a total analysis. And that spoke to the scientist in me, where they had looked at, you know, the children had gone through the surgery, but they look afterwards at, you know, the outcomes. And outcome studies were very important. So even in, Tommy had his first surgery in Minnesota in 2004. And even back then, that's about, 16 years ago, even back then, I could read outcome studies. So that, but also the logic of the treatment plan, like they, you know, Gillette had really worked out, you know, that there's the primary problems, very little we can do with those because they're caused by the brain injury. There are some things they can do for the spasticity, but for balance, not so much. For poor motor control, not so much. So they knew what they could address at the primary, but the growth problems, the problems with poor muscle growth and the muscle and bone problems, they could deal with that. So they could address it, but they had such a logical sort of plan, management plan, that it's you know, it spoke to me. So that's why, while everybody else was worrying about us going abroad for surgery, down to someone said, they cut too much in America. We weren't at all worried, you know. So we went in 2004. So Tommy had surgery when he was 9, and then he had further surgeries as he needed them. The plan is that you have a single event. It's designed to be, you know, all your corrections together. But some children need further surgeries. Like, the design is most of the corrections can be done together, you know, at that age. But in Tommy's case, he did need some, not as much, but some further surgery at 16 and 18. And just this year, he had a major surgery just before COVID shut down everything. He had a major surgery in the States again. And look, we were very lucky because he has had all his surgeries at the one center, because very unusually, they do both children and adults. You know, and that's like, this happens, this applies to a lot of conditions. When you have a lifelong condition, you know, there can be good pediatric care, but when a child comes to age 18, they kind of fall off a cliff with care. And when we went with a 9-year-old, we weren't thinking, think forward. You know, I was thinking sort of a month ahead, probably. That was my long range thinking. I wasn't thinking anything further. But so when we went at 9, but the fact that we went to a center that offers lifetime care, and like, Tommy now lives in the States and can access it very much more easily now.
That's wonderful. And I know in your book, you talk a lot about gross motor function and how small increases in gross motor function have a big effect on the child's life. Is that part of the surgery piece of it? Where does that come into play? What does that mean, you know, the small increases in the motor function? Or is that PT? What does that mean?
The surgery is designed, the surgery, say he had at age nine, things that would have been problematic for him. Like he was walking at that stage. Tommy started walking at 3, which was earlier than was predicted for him, but he started walking at 3. But by the time he had reached 9, he was walking with flexed knees, flexed hips, on his toe, you know, he was very flexed, you know, it's like, and I described this in the book, it's like as if you put your hand on someone's head and just push them down, they buckle at the joints. So the design for the surgery was to get him more erect, but also walking in with spastic diplegia is like they equate, it's like the energy it takes to walk with spastic diplegia is kind of equivalent to what it takes us to climb stairs. So you have a person, walking around on the flat using the same effort as it takes us to climb stairs. So the surgery was designed to sort of improve the energy efficiency of his walking. So those sort of things. Now, it would also give him a small increase in gross motor function, but it was particularly designed to improve energy consumption in walking and, make him more erect, you know, improve his gait in walking.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And, back to the book itself, I talked earlier about how you combined, your personal story as part of this book. Would you say the way this book is done that it's a new genre? Because I've never seen anything like this.
I would it is funny, the book evolved as I wrote it, combining the family story with and other families, not just my family, but other family stories, but with the deep medical knowledge. And I would think it's a new genre of books. And certainly, like it was published, Gillette themselves have formed a press, Gillette Children's Healthcare Press, because they've, they're quite excited about, they treat a large number of complex lifelong conditions, right? So it's not the sort of hospital you go to if a child just breaks its leg, a routine leg. It's complex, conditions like spina bifida, all the types of CP, and a lot of complex conditions they treat. So so there's a lot of families getting diagnosis like spastic diplegia. So they're very excited for other books like this, that are the deep medical knowledge. Like this book has, the evidence-based best treatments, and it's like, where is the medical science in this condition now? And they would like to do it for other books as well, for other conditions, so if you have a diagnosis of spastic diplegia, here's your book, but the other conditions. And what's different is, it's like I could accept Tommy's disability, no problem. I had no problem accepting it, but I wanted to make sure he was being limited by medical science. Like he had a brain injury, nothing I can do. I can't fix that, right? Nothing you can do there. But I just wanted to make sure that his treatment was at the limits of medical science. That, hopefully in 20 years' time, treatment will even be better. But at the moment, internationally, this contains the evidence-based best practice treatments. This is the limits of medical science for this condition now. Hopefully, I very much hope it'll be out of date soon and, that in a number of years, we'll have to update it. But I want to make sure, I could accept that my child had a physical disability, no issue with that. I just wanted to make sure that his treatment was as good as was available, right? That, that he got the best treatments. And we didn't do everything right at all. Like the procedure he had now, I wasn't aware of it at the time. He would have been much better off to have that at the age, 4 to 7, but I wasn't aware of it now. And it's called selective dorsal rhizotomy, where literally they take off, here I am putting my hand to my backbone, where they cut the vertebrae, expose the spinal cord, and sever sensory nerve rootlets that are causing a spastic response in his muscles, right? So they sever those and then close up everything. So in Tommy's case this year, they cut about 30% of the sensory nerves covering his legs, right? And that should improve. That should, you know, like Tommy has a normal life expectancy. So he's only 26 now. So, you know, that should help things for the future. It would have been much more ideal had he had that much earlier. I wasn't aware about it at the time. And by the time I went to, by the time, you know, it was too late by the time I was aware of it, he needed orthopedic surgery at that stage, not neurosurgery. But what I was, you know, like this book, like even in Ireland, that procedure is not available yet, right? It's still not available. Like it's been available for the last 30 years, roughly in, or the last 20, 30 years in the States. It's not available yet in Ireland. But if this book, if people know of the procedures, then it puts pressure on our services to provide them. So like that selective dorsal rhizotomy, the surgery Tommy had when he was 9, you know, they're still not accessible to us. So I want to, by making them known, we then know, like, I didn't know what I didn't know. Like, at least if you have a book, these are worldwide the best procedures. You know, it helps put pressure on to provide them.
And, you know, as they say, knowledge is power, right? So to give people the information so they can make the decisions. And again, I love the fact to put pressure on the medical communities in other countries that aren't doing this so they can do it. So I have a couple of questions. When you say Tommy has a brain injury, is that brain injury preventing certain, you know, sensory to reach the muscles? Or is there any other part of that brain injury that affects, because listening to Tommy, you would never, you know, a million years think he has a brain injury.
The funny thing, the funny thing, like he has a brain injury that causes sort of his tone in his muscles to be too high, so that there's a wiring problem that messages, like his muscles contract, over contract, right? So they become very tight. So like it's called spastic, that's what spasticity is. It's just an overpowering of, you know, an overfiring of nerves, right? But so he, that's what he has. Now, like the funniest thing of, not funny, I don't mean funny, but like I remember when he was diagnosed, he had a CT scan, right, shortly after diagnosis. And they gave me the, you know, so they did the CT scan. This was done at a center which, you know, he just was, you know, we were referred somewhere to get the scan done. And the consultant just said to me afterwards, literally, and I write about this in the book, you may have seen this, where he said, go home and look after your other children. Not a lot of active brain here. And I thought, like, Tommy's a year old at this stage. I thought, huh? I see a very alert child. Now, the child was sedated for the scan, so the consultant had never seen the child, Tommy, awake. Like, he'd only seen a sleeping child. But that was, when he read his scan, that's what he saw. And I said, wow. I said, you haven't seen my very alert. And it wasn't denial on my part. But to me, Tommy was, you know, very engaging, very alert. Like, obviously, there was a physical problem, no doubt there. But, I had no doubt that, there, you know, this was a very alert child, you know. So I actually parked that bit of information in a box. And I never really went, you know, because I thought, I see, the scan may be saying that, but I see a very different child. So as it happens, in answer to your question, like spasticity and balance problems would be the biggest problems he has. But other than that, like intellectually and cognitively, no problems. Like he can buy and sell me.
But there are...
That's an Irish expression we have. I'm not sure if you're familiar with...
No,
familiar with it, and I say, you know, intellectually no difficulty at all.
Okay, because there are certain forms of CP where there is an intellectual disability, correct?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. With spastic diplegia, it's a cognitive impairment is less common, but yes, you're right, and that's why That's why I go back to the point of it being such a CP is an umbrella term, and it's in a sense not useful. And it's in a, for us families, just please go to our diagnosis, go to our subtype, you know, that is so, you know, keep away from the umbrella term. Because, like, you know, I would read, you know, if I'm reading the CP, you know, about CP itself, it'll tell me, you know, cognitive impairment is not uncommon, you know. So, like, it's very important to break it down by subtype.
So, since there isn't a cure for CP at this point, you know, what can we hope for in the future?
That's like, that's actually very interesting. Like, I would say better yes, there isn't a cure currently. Maybe in time, you know, there's sort of better treatments of newborn, particularly, you know, at birth, you know, treatments of, you know, any, like CP is not a birth, just a birth, you know, call it a problem at birth. It's, you know, in a problem anytime before birth, at birth, or in the first 2 to 3 years. So it's a why, and like, sort of a problem during the pregnancy is not, you know, like, you know, people think of birth injuries. It's not just birth injuries. It's, as I say, before you ever get to the birth itself, and then in the immediate aftermath, the first 2 to 3 years, right? So, like, there will be, you know, and there's interesting work being done in stem cell, in the whole stem cell area, but I don't think there's going to be a cure. There isn't a cure imminent, right? What we can hope for is better management and treatment of the condition, right? So, you know, that's what we definitely can hope for. And two, families having better understanding. Like I, like you said, knowledge is power. I think if families know, and when I say about families, I mean parents of young children, but also adolescents and adults themselves. You know, the more they understand their condition, I think it helps to better outcome. And you know, that people have access to the evidence-based best practice treatments, you know, that people have good access to that. And like that, you know, if you have this condition, that you're limited by medical signs, not by postal code, not by where you live. And what did I think of, is there anything, like the other point I would make is that lifelong care, you know, that people have access to lifelong care, that there's too many who lose care once they've reached aged 18. Like, I want for all people with this condition, and I know I'm being very idealistic, but if you don't, you know, you have to be, you know, you have to think big, you know, but I want the best expert care and the best self-care. And then finally, research, you know, research in CP is so underfunded. It's the foundation of evidence-based care. And like, all proceeds from this book are going to CP research, you know, like anyone who worked with this book, like all the people from the hospital, like I just wanted this to be available. Like I didn't, like I'm retired now. I didn't mind pulling, you know, spending, like I feel I've done my lockdown writing the book. You know, it's funny that COVID, I timed it badly with COVID in the sense I did my 2 years lockdown researching and writing the book, but all proceeds from the book go to CP research, you know? So like in a sense, if I was to ask, you know, people who listen to this podcast, if I could make a request to them, you know, if you know of anyone with this condition, I would ask you, please, for the ebook costs $4.99, less than the price of 2 cups of coffee, would you send them a copy of the book? If you know somebody working, like be it a medical professional, be it an educational, you know, an educator, if you know of people working with people with this condition, will you send them a copy of the book? Or, you know, like just that I want families to get access to this information. You know, I want them to get access to the information in the book. So if I can, you know, ask people to just help share the information, and all proceeds go to research. Like there's nobody's bank balance going up with this book. It's all going to research.
That's wonderful, Lily. That's wonderful. Tell us about the process itself of writing the book. It took you 2 years, you mentioned. How grueling was it for you? And was it also gratifying to be able to put all of this together into, you know, one chronicle that now lives? What was that? What was that like, that whole process?
I enjoyed, I pitched the idea to Dr. Novacek at Gillette in late 2017. And, you know, once I convinced him that there was a need for this book, and once he could see it, he could see what I was arguing for. And once I pitched the argument to him, he was on board right from the start. And we put together the team here. So I went away and researched and worked on the book, and literally it was lockdown, because there was so much information. I found if I went away from it, I'd forget too much. So I stuck at it. So I did my pre-COVID lockdown for 2 years, just literally researching, writing. And then we did a few drafts, and I would send it to the editorial team, and they would review, give feedback, you know, and just kept working on it, did all the illustrations. There was a lot of pulling together of information, you know. But yes, it was tremendous hard work. Like I will admit, it took a lot of hard work, but I did enjoy it because I'd always been burning that there would be a resource for the condition, you know, that like I never forgot the pain I had of not understanding. And it was the pain I had of not understanding that drove me. And so it was hard work, but very gratifying. And like, it was funny because, and then I was delighted that Gillette Press came about, you know, Gillette Children's Healthcare Press, that they were so, you know, that they came on board and, you know, like they're so enthusiastic now about, yes, we need this for spastic diplegia, but the other conditions. So watch this space, that, you know, like there's plans for more books like that. And that excites me, that we have a new genre of books, and like that, you know, that families have, like writing the book, the biggest skill I needed for writing the book was to make very deep technical information accessible to families, right? That, you know, I wanted that, you know, you only needed a high school education to be able to access the information in the book. So it was kind of translating, you know, the latest research, but that any parent could pick up the book. And that took, like that, like we worked hard at that in terms of making it accessible, like, and including a lot of illustrations, full color, things like that, to make the information you know, that it was accessible. And like I say to people, just read it through, you know, if you're the parent of a newly diagnosed child, read the book through to give you a sense of the condition, and then you can dip in and out of the book as you need to.
I love that. So Lily, what are your hopes for the book? Where do you hope this goes?
That's interesting. What I would like for the book is that it reaches as many as possible of the 6 million people worldwide that have the condition. Like that would be one of my major hopes for the book. And like we try, you know, like the fact that, you know, this information is here, and like the ebook can go around the world. Like I love to hear about the ebook is in Guatemala, the ebook is in Uganda, you know, like it's only when you actually write a book you realize the importance of both print book and an ebook. Like the ebook can go anywhere. So it's to reach as many of those 6 million people, to also reach professionals who work with people with spastic diplegia, because it's the first time, you know, a focused book on the condition has been written, right? So it pulls together all the information about this condition. So to access, that professionals can get the book, and they in turn can recommend it to families. To reach parents like the parent I was, struggling for understanding, to reach parents and caregivers, like a survey of over 1,000 parents and caregivers in the US judged that available information to them, the information available to them was insufficient to guide their medical decision making. Like, they're making big decisions and they felt they didn't have enough they didn't have enough information. I want to reach those sort of parents. I want to reach the young adults who said they didn't, their greatest unmet need was information about their condition. I want to reach them. And I suppose, like, just to reach the people who need to understand, you know, what they're living with.
Wonderful. So this book came out right before COVID. I believe the first week in March you had the release, and then COVID happened. So what was that like, bringing it out at that time? Was that the right time?
Well, it was funny bringing it out. Like literally the 4th of March was the release date, and COVID came almost immediately after it. So, you know, of course, it's a funny time. Like, thankfully, the book is doing very well. Like, I'm happy to say it's doing very well. You know, it's selling both the ebook and the print book. It's selling very well. And, like, we've already had requests translated into Spanish, Vietnamese, Chinese, you know, I never thought about that. It wasn't that I wasn't expecting, I just never thought about that. Like, I thought we did well. And English, you know, I never thought, and I'm delighted to get those requests. Like, on the positive, in releasing a book in COVID time, people have more time to read. You know, people aren't going to as much. So to sit and read a book of this size, you know, they have more time. So that's a positive. The fact that, you know, the book is available online, all the Amazon market, and all Amazon marketplaces, you can order it through your bookstore. The ebook is on Amazon, the ebook is on Apple Books and all that. But the fact that you can buy, you know, it's available online, that's quite important as well during COVID times. You know what I mean? I wouldn't have thought of that, but COVID really brought it home to me that, you know, the fact you can buy these things online. The negative, I suppose, of bringing out a book in COVID times is there are less in-person events, right? So conferences are all gone virtual. And like, we had planned another launch in Ireland, actually, was the next launch in April, and that had to be cancelled. But people with spastic diplegia live with challenges all the time. I only say, right, this is our challenge. We have to get the book to the people who need it during COVID times. So, you know, I just have to emulate people who live with the challenge of spastic diplegia in terms of bringing out a book in COVID times.
So Lily, what would be one of the biggest lessons that came out of your experience with raising Tommy? If you were to look back and reflect on it, what was one of the biggest lessons that you learned?
I tend to be very optimistic, and it was a challenge, but I want Tommy to be a despite it, you know, and he wants to be a despite it, despite his spastic diplegia. You know, he's succeeding in life, you know what I mean? Like, he's living a life the very same as his older brothers. Like, I'm very happy that he's really happy with his outcome. And like, studies have shown that, like, even though spastic diplegia, you don't have a cognitive impairment, and really it's a mild, moderate physical disability, in the sense that most people with spastic diplegia are able to walk independently or with a handheld mobility device. Despite that, people with spastic diplegia, that they're underemployed, that, you know, compared with the typical population, they're underemployed. Fewer of them are in relationships, and fewer of them have children. And when I read that research when I was working on the book, that really shocked me, because here you have people with a mild, moderate physical disability, and yet compared with the typical population, fewer employed, fewer in long-term relationships and fewer with children. And to me, that shouldn't be. I think if, you know, like if people really understood the condition and if they had access to good care, the outcomes could be so much better. And that's what I'm lobbying for. You know, like, I'm proud that Tommy is out there, like that he had the confidence after high school to go off from Ireland. He went to New York to college, right? That he went to NYU to college, and that he had the confidence, you know, to leave Ireland and just go off, you know, and, you know, like that, like, he's living his life. You would not know from him there's anything wrong. And that's the biggest lesson, I think. You know, we all have to be despited people, that despite whatever in life, we just have to, you know, go out there, you know. So that's the biggest thing, you know. And like, it's funny, if I ever have any medical procedure, I feel I have to be the most perfect patient, because Tommy is so stoic in his, you know, approach to any treatments or anything, that I feel he's made me a much better patient. Like for instance, he had 6 hours of neurosurgery in February, 6-hour operation, right? And he was sitting up with us having dinner in the hotel on the following, he had the surgery on a Friday, he was sitting up having dinner by the following Tuesday night. Wow. In the hotel, out of the hospital, you know. He's amazing. So I learned from him, like, I genuinely learned from him. So, like, if I had a despited outcome, he has a despited outcome to the power of whatever.
And if you were to take out your cell phone right now and call yourself, that time when you heard that cry of Tommy, and you just had that feeling inside that something may not be quite right, what advice would you give that new mom?
Just go and, you know, go and find out, you know, just get the information and work out what you can do and what you can't do, you know, because there's lots you can't do. You know, I cannot, no matter what I do, you can never fix, you know, you can't, your approach isn't to fix, but it's to maximize on the strengths, you know, maximizing the strengths. You're not going to, you know, it is what it is, but just go forward and through knowledge, you know, just understanding. And like, it was a huge team effort. Like, I was so lucky. I was working with great professionals, both in Ireland and at Gillette in the States. You know, like, we were very lucky that we had the benefit of, you know, working with great professionals. And it's a huge team effort. It's like, it takes a village to raise a child. You know, it does, like, it takes a village to, I put that in the acknowledgements, I think, that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it certainly takes a village to raise a child with a disability, but it all, you know, and it also takes a village to write a book. But you know, just play to the strengths, you know, work with your team, and like, the sky is the limit, you know. Like if I took, you know, say there were times we were given negative I remember, like, the prediction was that Tommy would be he would walk when he was 7 and he'd be a wheelchair user in college, right? And that's why I remember I put the photograph of him walking out of college, you know, for his graduation, you know, that I didn't realize the significance of that, you know. And like, I sent that photograph to so many of the professionals who really had supported us on that long journey. But that, you know, so like, just believe, you know, it's kind of working out what's possible and what's not possible, but just working hard at what's possible.
Wonderful. Louie, congratulations on this remarkable piece of work. Well done. I cannot wait to help to promote this for you. It's such a wonderful cause. Before I let you go, last question I ask every guest, and that is, at the end of the day, you still have a lot of life to live, but what do you want your legacy to be? What type of mark do you want to leave on this earth?
I've always been passionate about education, so I'm very happy, you know, sort of like now in my, you know, to be working on education for families in complex conditions. And that, like, I would love my legacy that you helped a few families, as many as possible, but that, you know, that you could like that life could be a little bit better for some people because you've been around. Like when I was writing, when I was working on the book, there was a boy at one stage, I was working somewhere, and there was a boy who passed the window every day coming home from the nearby high school. And I knew he had spastic diplegia from the way he was walking. He passed every day. And when I was back there a year later, he was gone. The boy had gone to college, you know. And I actually found out who he was, and I sent, I gave a gift of the book to the mom. You know, that like if I don't know, I didn't know who the boy was, but just, and the mom was thrilled to get the book because she the mom was a friend of someone I knew, and she was delighted to get the book. But just that if some people, you know, if it helps some people with the condition, that would be all I'd ask for a legacy.
Well, and I have a feeling you're going to help many, many people, and wonderful work you're doing. You're creating massive impact on the world. You're creating massive awareness. Welcome to the American Real family, Lily. And thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Roger. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into American Real. Be sure to visit our website, AmericanReal.tv. Or search for us on iTunes or YouTube for past episodes. While you're there, please rate us or leave us a review, as that helps others find our show. I am truly grateful and appreciate all of your support. If you'd like to be part of our inner circle or want one-on-one coaching, check out the American Real Learning Academy, where we have self-help groups and courses so you can build the best you. We also have a new Facebook group where you can connect with high achievers from around the world. If you want to go even further, maybe you're determined to write your own book or launch your own podcast, contact me today to see if we could help. You can reach me through Instagram or Facebook, or email me directly at roger@americanreal.tv. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.